the 31st of January, Martha and I are scheduled to get on an airplane or two and fly down to Guyana, South America, and return to this country on March 2nd. And during our absence, we are to be in all 10 regions of the country. We're going to be dealing with a theme down there, if not now, when? And various things will be addressed. The things on which I'll be speaking will have to do with if not now, when will we lay groundwork for someday appointing elders. We want to talk about preparation, laying groundwork for someday, various congregations as they can appointing elders. And I'll also talk about edification. If not now, when will Guyanese brethren, in this instance, take more responsibility for their own edification? Others, we're talking about assuming more of their own financial responsibility, things of that nature, trying to encourage and edify our brethren down there to be full partners, as it were, in the work of the Lord. And so we look forward to coming back, and as opportunities present themselves in the future, I look forward to the opportunity to talk about a few things in the classes we might be able to be together in. After 40 years plus, I've got a few lessons that are tucked away that are presented over the years. We're going to look at one tonight. We're going to look at a PowerPoint on Bible archaeology. And I've not shown this particular PowerPoint in probably at least since we've been married, so at least 3 years. And so I spent hours this afternoon trying to refresh my memory of some of the things about which we're going to talk and some things we're going to display on the screen. But the idea of talking about Bible archaeology in our circumstance is to reinforce our faith, to give us the appropriate confidence that our faith has been appropriately placed in God's Word, the Bible. And Bible archaeology is one way in which we can grow our faith, we can strengthen our faith, because those things that are relative to Bible archaeology obviously are relative to Bible times or Bible places, Bible characters, Bible events, and they mesh real well together, showing that the Bible is accurate, is correct, that those things written therein are in fact something on which we can rely. Now this picture right here, now if you can't see from where you're sitting, I can't get this screen any closer to you. If you need to be closer to the screen, you're going to have to move your body a little bit closer. But if you can see fine from there, that's just, it's fine with me as well. Now this is a picture of some of the caves of in which the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in this outside this Qumran community. East of the city of Jerusalem, adjacent to the Dead Sea. And you see these caves are not really at the top accessible easily, and neither from the bottom or from the ravine. And so these several caves along this shoreline had secreted for about 2,000 years a number of things, including what we refer to as the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so these scrolls, as we will make mention, were found by accident. In 1947, some Bedouin shepherd boys were about looking for their sheep or tending their sheep, and they saw a cave and threw a rock inside, and they heard something break. And they went inside and found these scrolls that were inside these pottery jars. And they took some of them back to their encampment, and the fellow Bedouins in the encampment began using these leather scrolls to mend their shoes. And a few of these scrolls made their way into a village or a town, and Westerners observed what they were and expressed interest in them, and finally these caves were ferreted out, and then excavations over a number of years occurred, and hence we have what are referred to as the Dead Sea Scrolls. Here we have, this is not relative to the Dead Sea Scrolls, this is a bone box or an ossuary. And this particular bone box or ossuary belonged to a man in our language whose name would be John. Now, an ossuary is about the size of a cedar chest, a small cedar chest, a toy box, or a hope chest, about 2 feet long, and will have some, and about 10 inches wide and 12 inches tall, carved out of marble or carved out of limestone. And the process was, in the use of an ossuary or a bone box was, if there's a tomb or a rock-hewn tomb or a natural cave that was being used for a family burial, that when a family member died, you take your family member to that cave or to that tomb and lay that person out. And 1 year later, you come back and all the soft tissue is gone, all you have left are the bones, and you would gather up the bones and put them in this ossuary box, and then you tuck the box away in the corner of the cave or the tomb, making ready for another family member who may pass away, and then the process would repeat itself. In this particular case, the bones of an individual named John were in this ossuary when it was unearthed. This ossuary has bones in it that are relative to physical evidence of crucifixion. Now, there are a lot of things about which we could read in the Bible for which we do not need any physical evidence, because we have agreement between the biblical text as well as secular history. And crucifixion would be one of those areas in which we don't need to have physical evidence regarding did crucifixion occur in the first century. It was occurring. It's verified by not only the biblical text, but by secular history. But in this particular instance, in this box, in among these bones, we find physical evidence that corroborates not only the secular historical account, but also the biblical narrative that crucifixion was occurring in the first century. Now, there are a number of reasons for which, before this occasion, there was not physical evidence to substantiate or corroborate the historical evidence or the historical testimonies in the biblical narrative. You see, nails, iron, it rots or rusts away, it dissolves, doesn't leave any trace, and so forth. And so the bones were gathered and put into this box, and inside this were found ankles that had iron nails about 6 inches long going through them, indicating that this individual had been nailed to a cross through his ankles. And this is what we have as far as that aspect of it's concerned. We have on the top left-hand picture the actual bone fragment there on the right. Here we have a recreation of the foot on the left to show what part of foot that would have been through which the nail was going. Here we have a close-up view of the bone fragment with the iron nail going through it. And then we have an artist rendition of it. You see that the nail is curved over on the end. And so in all probability, if this nail hadn't hit a knot in the wood, or whatever the case was that caused it to bend over, that nail would have been removed and used on some other poor victim in the future. They couldn't get the nail out. And so they left the nail in the bones of this individual. And then because of this particular temporary, as it were, in history, way of burying Jewish dead, this iron nail was preserved in this ankle bone. This is an artist's depiction of a possible way in which this individual was crucified. Sometimes the individuals were tied to the crosses, sometimes they were nailed to the crosses. I don't know why this artist decided to mix it up a little bit. We have him tied on top and nailed on the bottom. But our purpose of looking at this illustration is to see that on the way that this picture depicts that and agrees with the way in which that iron nail was going through the ankle of that individual named John in that box. There are a number of different ways in which the Jews buried their dead, and it varied from time to time. The patriarchs buried their dead along the route of travel. We mentioned it in one of our classes, and they would do so either in shallow graves, or they would, in the case of Abraham, he bought a cave, had to buy the field too to get the cave. A cave of Machpelah near Hebron became a family burial place. Or there were shaft graves that were used by the Essenes, and these were about 6 feet deep, and the head of the individual was there toward us right there, and his body would extend oppositely from there. And then it would be the shaft grave would be blocked off with stone here, and then backfilled. And then we have a variety of different types of ossuaries that would be used. Some of them were very plain, like the John's ossuary that we examined first. Others would be very ornate, like this one is, have a vaulted top on it. So some had flat tops, some had vaulted tops, some were plain, some were decorated. And they usually had the names of the one inside on the outside of it. And usually they would have two names on it, the ossuary, one of which would be the father of the individual who's in there, as well as the name of the individual who is there. And so there were a lot of names that were similar, a lot of common names. People were using the same names. We do that too. And so in order to distinguish which John or which Joseph or which Harry or whomever would be in there, would also name his father. So it would be so-and-so, son of, and then name his father. That was the typical way of identifying who's in there. Or at least to have the name of the individual by which he was known, and then also have the family name associated with that to tell who is there. These ossuaries have been removed from their original resting places and have been placed in a museum. They wouldn't be arranged quite like that. And this is a description of an ossuary. Some of the information that we've already mentioned: bone box, 2 feet long, made out of limestone or marble. A Jewish custom for burial that only lasted from 100 to 200 years. And this particular practice of burying the dead in ossuaries or bone boxes predated the time of Christ and post-dated the time of Christ. And so when somebody finds an ossuary, they know the relative time period during which this ossuary was used. They know what time period to relate to the individual who may be there, or other artifacts or other things that may be associated with that burial site or that burial ossuary. And so from the time of Herod the Great till AD 70 at the destruction of Jerusalem was the primary time during which the Jews were using ossuaries in which to bury their dead. And this was a second type of burial. Again, we mentioned you lay out the body. A year later, you come back and all that's left are the bones. That's when you have the second burial, a collection of the bones, place them in the ossuary, and then place the ossuary off to the side in the tomb. And the top picture is an ossuary with a vaulted or domed top for a lid. But the significant thing about this particular ossuary is that it is supposed to resemble Herod's temple in the first century. It may surprise you, but we don't have any photographs of the temple in the first century. We don't have any drawings of it either. We have some physical descriptions of it in the historical writings of Josephus. And we also have this ossuary, which was carved to resemble the temple in Jerusalem in the first century. And then the bottom picture right there is on the inside of a tomb. You see that there's a ledge on which is resting one ossuary right there. We have niches that are carved underneath the ledge in the side of the wall. Here we have another niche right here that has been closed off with a little stone door. We have another ossuary down here in this niche, and there's no door covering it. It gives you an idea of what it would be like, a family burial place, comparable perhaps to a mausoleum in our time. And then this is a very special ossuary, and this ossuary is very decorated. But the significant thing regarding this ossuary is we know who's inside. At least we know one of the individuals inside. In this ossuary are the bones of 6 people: 2 infants, a child aged 2 to 5 years old, a teenage boy, and an adult woman. The man inside was about 60 years old. This bone box, this ossuary, has on the side of it that this is Caiaphas. It identifies with the high priest who condemned Jesus Christ and sent him to the Romans to be crucified. This is the only discovery to date of a biblical character, the remains of a biblical character. And the irony of it all is that here's the individual's remains who condemned Jesus Christ to die. We still got him, but Jesus is not in the grave. He arose from the grave and he resurrected from the grave and then ascended back to the Father in heaven. And so I find this particularly interesting. And again, this corresponds directly in every respect with the biblical account. This is another ossuary called the James Ossuary. There's nothing special about this ossuary as far as what it looks like, or it's not different in any substantial way from other ossuaries. This bone box or ossuary was given a permit by Israel to go on display in a museum in Canada. On the way to Canada, the box broke and had to be repaired. Upon going through the exercise of trying to mend the box to repair it, somebody paid attention to the inscription on it. it says that James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. And then when that hit the headlines, everybody was excited about that, not for the same reasons. The Israeli government was very excited, but not because they were happy about the situation at all. They don't want this to be relative to Jesus of Nazareth. They don't want this to be relative to the one that the world views as the Messiah. And so the box underwent a lot of investigation, a lot of analysis, both from the analysis of the inscription on the box as well as analysis of the composition of the box itself, to determine, is it genuine? Genuine as far as the inscription is concerned, genuine as far as the box dating back to the time period that it's supposed to be from. The problem with this is that this box was purchased on the antiquities market. And so when something's purchased on the antiquities market, there's no documentation relative to where it was found, when it was found, by whom it was found. No way to ascertain, is it a fraud, a forgery, or on the other hand, is it a genuine article? Now, the bones of the individual are not in the box, but here we have this box. It on the side of it says the inside that box one time were the bones of somebody named James, son of Joseph, and brother of Jesus Christ, or rather, brother of Jesus. And so this caused quite a stir, of course, both by those who were interested in ascertaining, is this the box in which were at one time the remains of the half-brother of Jesus and also the author of the book of James, or is this something else? Because this was obtained illegally from a midnight dig or something like that, no documentation, obtained illegally from the ground and then sold to the antiquities market, that paper trail that's needed to show its authenticity is not there. And so it has to be evaluated. And so various individuals who have evaluated have determined that the inscription is accurate or genuine. It's accurate and genuine from the consideration of using the shape of letters and using the spelling, for instance, that would be that would correspond to the first century. And also the material out of which the box is made corresponds to it coming from Palestine or from Canaan. The box had been cleaned, and so that damages some of the ability or prevents or hinders some of the ability to ascertain the age of it. For instance, the aging of the patina, the antiquing that would be in the crevices of the inscription carved in it, the antiquing and patina, the aging of the box itself would be affected somewhat. And so obviously for political reasons and for religious reasons, there are a lot of individuals who don't want this to be the box in which at one time were the bones of the brother of Jesus and the writer of the book of James. And then there are a lot of individuals, on the other hand, who want this to be exactly what we would at first think it would be, the box in which at one time were the bones of James, the half-brother of Jesus, and the author of the book of James. Now, it doesn't make any difference to your Christian faith or my Christian faith one way or the other, because our faith isn't based on something of this nature. Our faith is based on a different type of evidence. Romans 10 and verse 17, so then faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. And so if this were in fact the box in which at one time were the bones of James, the half-brother of Jesus, as well as the author of the book of James, it's simply one more of thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of archaeological evidence to corroborate the biblical account. But on the other hand, if it's not relative to that particular Jesus, or if it were a forgery, it doesn't affect our faith, because our faith is based on a different type of evidence. Our faith is based on, so then saith the word of God, or the word of the Lord. And so it can only be useful to us. It can't be harmful to us, irrespective of the outcome on that. It appears as though this is the box in which at one time were the bones of the half-brother of Jesus and also the author of the book of James. This is one of a few temptation seals. Usher's chronology of the Bible dates the creation at about 4,000 B.C. or approximately 6,000 years ago from the present. And his chronology and others like Hale, who have come up with a similar competing chronology or or from the Bible ascertaining when biblical events occurred, such as creation and other events. Also placed it at thousands of years ago as opposed to millions or billions of years ago, as would be the case with those of an evolutionary mindset. Now, as far as genuine science is concerned, it can be proven that this earth on which we live is no older than 10,000 years. From biblical chronologies, not simply genealogies, but chronologies having to do with time, having, of course, to do with the genealogies in the book of Genesis in particular, the earth falls, the age of the earth or creation falls within that 10,000 years. And so the 6,000 years ago or 5,000 B.C., as Hale would have us believe, those are all within the range of what can be proved by physical evidence or by scientific evidence. Now, I say all of that to say this, that this seal depicts the fall of mankind in the Garden of Eden. We have a woman and a man, a snake and a fruit tree. And the snake is standing erect, and the woman is reaching for, or at least one of them is reaching for the fruit, woman or maybe both of them. And this seal is dated at 5,500 years old. That makes this seal, if that dating is accurate, almost as old as dirt, almost going all the way back to the time of creation. There's another seal called the Adam and Eve seal, which is dated at 3,500 B.C., and so it placed it near the time of creation. The Adam and Eve seal depicts a naked man and naked woman hunched over and as though they're being driven from a garden, and the snake also following them. And these are in various museums around the world. Again, archaeological discoveries. Some of the most startling archaeological finds bear upon the historicity of the first 11 chapters of Genesis, a portion of the Bible that even some Bible-believing scholars have had difficulty accepting at face value. Among these is the temptation seal found among the ancient Babylonian clay tablets and presently in the British Museum. And then somebody else makes the observation, some writers have doubted that there is any real significance to these seals as evidence for the fall. However, the specific percentages and elements cannot easily be dismissed in such fashion. For what reason should an artist select such a theme by which testimony is made as to the cause of man's degradation? Rather, one should select a theme that would enhance man's image. When somebody writes an autobiography, how many of the failures in their lives do they typically put at the forefront, or maybe even mention at all? When things aren't going well in our lives and we're down and out, are those the things about which we want to write and present to the world? When man writes an autobiography, it hits the highlights and all the times in his life when things are going really well and all the achievements and all the attainments that are attributable to him or to her. If we were, as humans, writing about our origin and our condition, if we were writing the autobiography of mankind, we wouldn't talk about the fall in the Garden of Eden. We wouldn't be making pictures of it and whatnot. We'd want to present a different portrait to the world and to whomever might see it regarding who we are and what we were, what we've become. It is difficult to explain what the three figures engraved on a seal dating from the beginning of human antiquity are doing if the artifact is not another depiction of the Genesis account. Now, there are, in all of the cultures around the world, all kinds of things that are in their histories that are comparable to things about which we read in the Bible, particularly in the book of Genesis, like a universal flood, like the Tower of Babel. And though their details may not match up with what the Bible says, for instance, polytheism on the hand of those secular histories and monotheism or one God on the part of the followers of God or what the Bible says, essentially, the details, or rather the main events, are the same and serve to in large corroborate the things about which the Bible speaks or records upon its pages. We move over to the Dead Sea Scrolls, and this is a picture of the Dead Sea, of the Salt Sea. We have on the western side, we have the city of Jerusalem right there. Here we have Jericho, 14 or 16 miles away. And we have Hebron down here. There's Bethlehem, 5 miles south of Jerusalem. We have Masada. You might have seen a movie about that. That's comparable to the Alamo as far as the Jews' last stand against the Roman armies. You know, the Jews revolted against Rome in AD 66, AD 70. Rome crushed Jerusalem. Last holdout was on top of this mountain of Masada. And so as the Romans were about to come up crashing through the wall, they had mass murder-suicide on top of the mountain. This was the last stand of the Jews at that particular place and time regarding that revolt that began in AD 66 and led to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Along the western shore, we have various caves. And these are the caves in which were found the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have several of the caves relative to a little community called Qumran, believed to have been places where the Essenes live, one of the sects of the Jews, though not mentioned in the Bible, mentioned in historical records. And so we have, again, the pictures with which we began of the rugged, isolated, inhospitable area in which were these Dead Sea Scrolls discovered in 1947. And then I like this particular description. I don't want to be where this was. I don't want to go visit where that was. But I can certainly appreciate how colorful the circumstances were where these Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Inside the caves were not clean and neat and level. On the contrary, they were often very difficult to excavate in. In cave 4, there were 6 feet of bat dung and dust deposited over 2,000 years that the Bedouin and the archaeologists had to wade through in the stifling heat in order to try to extricate the fragments. A few of the scrolls, about 10 or so, were beautifully preserved and largely intact, like the scrolls of the book of Isaiah. But most of it consists of a lot of tiny fragments. Now, this is in one of those caves. You know, you're halfway up the canyon wall, and the canyon wall continues above the opening here. And you're inside one of these caves, and you're looking out. And so the valley or the ravine drops at your feet, and then you see that no vegetation. It's a very inhospitable area. We have the Dead Sea right there, and we have mountains rising up on the other side. And so there was a perfect environment as far as preservation of some of the things found in the Dead Sea caves, and as well as an isolated area that wouldn't be visited or trampled upon very much by people over the centuries. This is a sample of some of what was found in the caves. We have fragments. We have others that are more intact but still have some ragged edges. We have more fragments. Some of them were on leather. Other types of material, papyrus, were also apparently involved in some of them. This is the Dead Sea Scroll of Isaiah. Now, this is really a remarkable find. The copy of the Dead Sea Scroll of Isaiah here is intact. It has all of the chapters and all of the verses of the book of Isaiah that's in our Bibles. One of the remarkable things is that the book of Isaiah that's in our Bibles was translated from a manuscript that was 1,000 years younger than the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scroll was 1,000 years older than the manuscript from which our Isaiah was translated. There were no printing presses. Everything had to be copied by hand, one letter at a time, from one manuscript to another. And so with human involvement, there's always the possibility for things not to be quite what they're supposed to be. We make mistakes. We make errors. And so we might ask ourselves, we might prepare ourselves, what kind of differences might we expect regarding the copy of the book of Isaiah that's 1,000 years older than the copy used to make the translation of the book of Isaiah that we use? has all of the chapters, has all of the verses. There are no differences except inconsequential variations such as spellings or, you know, put a word in twice, something of that nature, things that are easily discernible, no difference in doctrine, no substantial difference whatsoever. And we don't have time to address it tonight, but there was such carefulness and such exactness with which the manuscripts were copied as they made more of them by hand. If they made any mistake whatsoever, they would throw the whole, they'd throw the page away. They have a certain number, a small number of mistakes were found on any one page, the whole document would be destroyed and start all over again. And so the effort was to make it exactly right. And yet we still make mistakes, but the mistakes are so inconsequential that we can be assured that what we have today and we hold in our hands, either in some type of traditional Bible format or on a cell phone or tablet, is exactly what God gave mankind as far as its teaching is concerned. We have God providentially preserving it for us, and so we can know what God wants us to know, and therefore can act appropriately regarding that information that He has provided for us. This is the roof of a museum in Jerusalem in which are housed the Dead Sea Scrolls. And you probably haven't seen a roof like that before. That roof is supposed to resemble the jar lid of the clay pots in which the Dead Sea Scrolls were secreted in those caves along the Dead Sea. Now, we come to the remains, the ruins of the capital city of the Hittites. There always have been Bible critics. And one of the things about which Bible critics have been so often to say in criticism of the Bible is that there never was a civilization or an empire known as the Hittites. And yet we find about 40 references in the Old Testament referring to the Hittites. But there's nothing in the historical record of Hittites ever having existed. There's nothing as far as a physical excavation site or a circumstance where you can go somewhere and see the remains of what the Hittites were doing historically. That is until the end of the 20th century. And then up in the mountains of Asia Minor, or that is up in the mountains of Turkey, remote rugged area, there's this mammoth 800-acre site, ruins of the capital city of the Hittites. And it was a mammoth place. And the Hittites were a superpower in their day. They were a tribe that had come down from Europe and had conquered the native peoples of Asia Minor, or what today would be called Turkey. And they were not empire builders. They were marauders. They were robbers. They would take their armies and they would go and they would conquer a city. They would plunder it and then they'd go back home. They did not try to expand the borders of their influence. They would go, take, and go back home again. And so unlike the Babylonians, unlike the Romans, unlike the Greeks, unlike the Persians, they didn't leave behind themselves great monuments of towers and walls and whatever else. From their presence, they went, they took, and they went back home again. They were so powerful that they were fighting for dominance with other nations for 700 years in the Fertile Crescent, a piece of land going from the Persian Gulf in a northwesterly direction to the northeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea and going down along the Palestinian coast, going down to Egypt. And so they fought with Egypt, they fought with the Assyrians, they fought with the Babylonians. They fought with the Sumerians. And then after this discovery of the capital city, all around that part of the world, other sites relative to the Hittites were likewise simultaneously being discovered. Among other things, in the ruins of this capital city was a library found of 10,000 clay tablets. Among those clay tablets, they found a peace treaty with Egypt. And then in two different places in Egypt, there are in cuneiform or in hieroglyphics copies of that peace treaty with the Hittites. The Hittites and the Egyptians were fighting on land near the Orontes River in the Palestinian Assyrian coast. near where later the New Testament time was Antioch of Syria. And the Hittites overpowered the Egyptians. And the Egyptians were running for their lives, including Pharaoh, running for his life. But the Hittites did not pursue them. The Hittites were plunderers. They plundered the Egyptian camp. And by the time that they're done plundering the Egyptian camp, reinforcements from Egypt come. Instead of fighting again, they decide, let's have a peace treaty. And so they had a peace treaty there at the Orontes River. We knew nothing about the Hittites. And now we know so much about the Hittites. For instance, we also know how the movements of the various military forces were going at the Orontes River on the occasion about which I was speaking. Much like we could look at maybe something on TV or documentary about the movement of Nazi forces and Allied forces along Europe in World War II. You have the exact same amount of information and can depict the same movements. These troops, these troops, these troops, these troops. So much information has fallen into our hands through excavation that they're no longer an obscurity, that they're no longer an absence from history, but history has to be amended because of all the evidence that has been discovered regarding Hittites. Now, there were people living up here where these ruins are, but they were people who would have maybe built three walls backing up against the ruins of a wall for the city. They were people that you'd find today going over to the rural areas of India or Pakistan or Myanmar or a lot of other places that are just not modern places to which we could go today. And that don't have a knowledge of the rest of the world outside of their own village or whatever. So people were living there, didn't know who had been there before, didn't care, until Westerners come along and find these sort of things. These are some of the gates going into the ruins of the Hittite capital there. This is a map showing the influence of the Hittites. The white area is the influence of the Hittites. We have them, their influence stops right here at the Orontes River where the Egyptian influence is, and we have also the Assyrians and the Babylonians to the right of that. Then we have Hittite battle tank. Everybody that was in wars had armies, had chariots, horses and chariots. And the typical chariot had solid wheels, had one driver and one warrior. But the Hittites modified their chariots. They used spoked wheels, gave them greater maneuverability, made them lighter, and so they could put another person on the chariot. And so whereas all the opponents of the Hittites had one driver and one warrior in the chariot, the Hittites had two warriors and one driver, a warrior on either side of the driver. And so they were invincible on flat ground in their chariots. We have a carving of a Hittite chariot on a wall there, and then we have some depictions also of that. Here we have Hittite warriors on top left and right, and we have a Hittite copy, of peace treaty with Egypt on the bottom. We have a husband and wife Hittite carved into a wall on the right. We have a figurine of a Hittite woman on the left. We have a Hittite jug on the left. We have Hittite seals on the right. Now we come to the Moabite stone. The Moabite stone is 34 lines of Hebrew text. It was written by the kingdom of Moab. It parallels a biblical account of a conflict between the Israelites and Moab. In the Bible, we have accounts of when Israel was winning. The Moabite stone talks about the occasion on which the Moabites were winning. This stone was found lying on his back on top of the ground in a Bedouin camp. And Westerners have tried to negotiate for it, but negotiations didn't go very well. And so the Bedouins heated up till this black rock was white. They had it put it over a fire, then poured water on it. And it broke into about 30-some pieces, and they secreted the pieces in the granaries of various villages. Eventually, negotiations were complete, and most of the pieces were retrieved, not all of them. Now, while negotiations were going on, there was a papier-mâché impression made of the text. And so though a few of the pieces are missing, the text has been preserved by reason of the impression that had been made of it. The significance of this is not only corroborating the same events about which the Bible speaks, but from the Moabite perspective, but also mentions the very name of the tribe, the Israelite tribe that the Moabites were fighting. It names the house of David, if I recall correctly. It names God, Yahweh, and spelled the same way that the Hebrews spelled it, the same way it's spelled in the Bible. And it's in so many ways it is a remarkable find, and again corroborates the biblical account. This is a black obelisk we have here, the only known picture of a biblical character. The man bowing on this monument is King Jehu. This chronicles also a biblical account of Israel being subject to Assyria. But the Bible does not record this particular occasion. This occasion shows, in text and also pictures, various kings that the Assyrians had conquered that are bowing down to them, and chronicles how much tribute was received. And this bowing down figure is King Jehu bowing down, and he brought with him 10 silver and gold as tribute to the Assyrian king. This is the last picture. Apparently a good thing because we're running out of time. But this is Hezekiah's tunnel. I can't hardly see it, but there's a man walking through the water right there about chest high. And King Hezekiah, in anticipation of the Assyrians attacking Jerusalem, commissioned the digging of a tunnel from a pool of water outside the walls of Jerusalem to a cistern on the inside of the walls. And so they would have water available in the event of attack. This tunnel is about 1,800 feet long. It was built from both ends. It's in serpentine fashion. It goes like this, and then meets in the middle. And they have different carved inscriptions relative to the completion of that tunnel in the middle there. And we find out the length of a biblical cubit from a sign carved regarding this tunnel. And we find that they say the tunnel is 1,200 cubits long. Well, it's 1,800 feet long. And so doing the math comes out to 18 inches for a cubit, from usually from the end of one's fingers to the point of one's elbow. Of course, that can vary from person to person. So all of these things should help us to reinforce our faith, to have confidence that the Bible, in fact, is God's deserved word for us. And so we can move forward in our faith as well as encouraging and strengthening others regarding the Christian faith. Time is gone. If you have questions, comments, or criticisms, please reserve those for after our devotional tonight. Thank you very much for your kind attention.